Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Politics and Polemics, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Megu. I also host my own podcasts, Independent Thought and Freedom, and also A Story Club, Global Politics, and Global Cultures. The links are in the NBN sidebar. Today, my guest is Jodie Forrester, author of the book, Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary, published by Odyssey Books, just published a few days ago, correct?
Yes, September 1st.
All right, great. Well, welcome, Jodie, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
Right. I see, you know, from going through your book, we share many passions. Some of them are in the past, but, you know, from the Black Panthers to revolutionary Marxism to Kurt Vonnegut Jr. I mean, A Cat's Cradle, in fact, that very book you mentioned inside there, Cat's Cradle, it was the first adult book I ever read in my life. I was like, I don't know, I think 13. And it got me to understand for the first time that a fiction book could be more entertaining and stimulating than TV or movies. It was a great discovery for me, you know. But tell me, how does that fit into your story in Guns Under the Bed?
What was happening at the time, I was in a Maoist organization that was very much adhering to the ideology of Mao's theories and practices. And one of the most critical rules, as it were, to follow was that all conversation, all reading, all interactions had to be political, that there was nothing more important than what they called the mass line, and individual pleasures such as reading or having friends outside of the organization were simply not permitted. But
And if I just interject here, at the time, the Cultural Revolution was in full swing in China, right? And this yes. was kind of this what was going on there, which was later denounced by Deng. But at the time, that there was, you know, persecution of intellectuals and whatnot as being counter-revolutionaries, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so if my organization, my collective knew that I'm a longtime reader of novels and fiction of all sorts and very much disapproved. So I, rather than standing up because, you know, I was 17, 18 years old, I just snuck them. I would read them when nobody knew I was, because no matter what my commitment was to the ideology, I couldn't give them up.
Yeah. That's an amazing thing. I mean, you were 17 or 18, part of this organization. And there's so much, relevance for what's going on today. And I certainly want to bring that in. But To concentrate on the meat of your book, Bill Ayers, who wrote a little blurb at the beginning, he has something that I think is an important thing that we can take off on, which is every memoir turns on a fundamental question. How did a person like this get into a place like that? So really, how did you get into that at 17 or 18 years old?
To be honest, that is the question that I needed to answer, which drove my writing the book in the first place. I was always cognizant of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, and so many others. And I had a very strong moral sense of what was right, what was fair. And I was as soon as the Vietnam War came to the houses via television and to see the horrors that the United States were perpetuating there, I was on the streets as a protester at that point while I was still in high school. And when I went to college initially, I was...
Can I ask you the year that would have been?
1969. Well, no, actually, I graduated in 1969. That was in 1967, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you were how old?
15.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It helps me contextualize it. Yeah, go on.
When I first went away to college, I was very much needed to find like-minded people. And there I saw a brochure for an anti-war rally that I went to. And there were many speakers, but there was one speaker in particular that held my attention. He talked about the necessity of essentially overthrowing capitalism and imperialism. And for me, that was a huge revelation because previously we knew about we could do this and we knew we could do that. But here was like a singular path that once committed to could actually make a difference in the world. And I was enthralled and found out more about it. He was a member of the organization called Revolutionary Union. And over time, I saw that that was where I wanted to be as well.
Oh, that's so. So you just sort of went and volunteered yourself to it, did you?
Not volunteered. I was really just in the audience. It wasn't really an audience. We were just standing around on the quad. But I was very intrigued and I went to speak further with that speaker. And the way to get into the organization is you really had to be educated to a point of knowledge of Marxist-Leninism. And one doesn't just volunteer in the organization, one has to be recruited. Right. And I underwent a pretty intensive tutoring session with that individual to the point that I at least had a grasp intellectually of the ideology and practices of Mao Zedong, and had many discussions with the regional chairman, Barry Greenberg, of the organization until he felt I was ready to join.
Okay. And so how old are you while you were learning Marxist revolutionary theory?
17.
17. Yeah. I know in the book you had mentioned one of your colleagues who was still in high school, and he had Professor Perrins in Palo Alto, and he was recruited by a professor. I can't remember if it was
Bruce Franklin. Princeton.
Right. Was it your recruiter? Was he a professor?
Oh, no. He was just another freshman, but he had also been in Palo Alto. The organization's seeds began in Palo Alto under the auspices of Dr. Franklin and a few other people. So Joe, his name is, he came to San Jose with the intent of expanding membership of the Revolutionary Union.
Yeah, that's it. I'll tell you, it's very, very interesting for me because when I was around 15 years old myself, and I was born in 68, so in the 80s when I was in high school, there was a kind of activism coming up then, you know, with you had this big Band-Aid and Live Aid, the Ethiopian crisis, but then later you had things like Amnesty International, and that kind of captured people's imaginations widely in a popular way. But then in my school, there were these radical liberation theologists. I went to a Catholic school, and they introduced me to all this sort of FMLN going on in El Salvador, and then the history of the civil rights movement, and the stuff you went through, right? And so we kind of idolized all that kind of stuff you guys did. And you know, I remember I was also like 15 years old, joining in my first protest, and on a corner, it was some nuclear arms issue. We were protesting. There was a plant nearby, and so we were drawn in. You know, and I was sort of enthralled. You know, by all that stuff and discovering a whole new world. And I myself, you know, got involved in even an anarchist organization where I was. Mm. But we looked to you guys, what you were doing in the 60s, you know, with this kind of admiration. And I mean, I never got in anything violent like, you know, like you were talking about. I don't know. You start off the book talking about not really a violent incident, but, you know, something that could have turned violent. I mean, you guys had your guns, you were pointing it at the door, anticipating, quite mistakenly, that a policeman would enter your room. Was that the most sort of traumatic or most violent or potentially violent incident you got yourself involved in?
It was the most potentially violent, because if they had come in as we anticipated, there would have been a shootout. And who knows who would have survived that. However, there were also street marches where windows were being broken. And I also describe in my book, the most violent activity that I participated in was when Richard Nixon came to San Jose on some kind of run to gather support for his reelection. And there were thousands and thousands of people waiting outside for him because he had just created this huge layoff of engineers primarily. And so a lot of very angry people were there. There were rocks being thrown. There was a convoy of limousines. He was in the last, he famously stood up on the hood of his car and flashed two fingers in what could have been, I mean, in the United States, that means peace.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in Britain, it means something much more. Yeah. So that infuriated the crowd even more. And there was a construction site right behind where we were, and people were gathering bits of concrete to throw at the limos. And I turned out to be right next to his limousine. I mean, he was literally arm's length away, and somebody put a rock in my hand. And it took me a minute, but I was so angry. We were all so angry that I just started banging it against his window. I could see his face through it. My own face was reflected in it, and I just banged and banged and banged. The window was splintering, and then they were able, then the convoy began moving, and as I say in the book, my hand, I didn't even realize how bloody it had gotten.
Yeah.
So that was the most overt violence. I was with people, my comrades were throwing rocks at windows as we marched, but I didn't have really the arm strength to make a difference. So I didn't actually do that.
Yeah. Have you seen, have you seen the viral clip of some protesters shouting at a woman? I think it was in Washington, just having a meal and crowding around her and telling her white silence is violence. And it was this really this kind of mob activity. Have you seen that viral clip?
I have not. This is something that was recently broadcast.
Yes. I think last week. Because I wanted to know how familiar that would have felt to you, because it did seem like, I mean, it was obviously, you know, some mass hysteria, and that's going on throughout the country. I mean, with all this stuff that we're seeing, the riots and you know, tearing down of statues and all these sort of protests and counter protests, how does that strike you, given your experience?
We would never have rounded on one individual. It was always representatives of capitalism. And even the stores I questioned, I was very unhappy with trashing small shops, small shop owners. But it was made clear to me, and I have to say, I had trouble with this, but they were representative of capitalism. And on any level, anybody participating in the capitalist system was the enemy.
Yeah.
So I see it now. And at first I was, you know, pretty upset because how can you not be? But ultimately I understand it. I understand that what is a store, what is a department store, what is a police station compared to 400 years of severe malignant intent towards people of color. And exactly, as I said, I don't really condone it. And but also the reality is it was a very small percentage of people. And many of them were people who were just taking advantage of all these goods being available. Yeah. But as I said, I do understand it, particularly coming from the from people of color.
Now, let me ask, how long were you involved in the RU?
3.5 years.
3.5 years, right. And so what type of activity were you involved in the group?
Mostly there were study groups. There were there was strategizing. There were demonstrations that we initiated and led. I was often the person that was the holding the megaphone saying, let's go, because I was really good at riling people up. But a lot of the majority actually of our work was education, was trying to let people know what was going on and who the oppressors were.
Right, right. So like in terms of like other groups like, you know, the Weather Underground, you know, for example, and the Black Panthers, you know, so did you have any relations with them at all?
The Black Panthers, we actually tried to bring under the umbrella of the Revolutionary Union. Some of them were interested, but mostly they really didn't want to join a white hierarchical organization. They had their own agenda. But we did work in tandem with them. We shared the podium, the platform for speeches. The Weather Underground were a completely different organization. We knew about them, but they were based in Chicago and back east, and we were on the West Coast, so there was really no overlapping. They were thought to be without ideology. I mean, the majority of the Weather Underground were college graduates who came from a pretty comfortable middle class background, white, all white, and we didn't really, frankly, approve of their tactics. That said, there was appreciation. I mean, I remember thinking, "Wow, that's amazing. That's really cool what they're doing."
Right. I'm interested in the Black Panthers quite a bit. Who was on the platform that you guys shared with anybody that might know, like Fred Hampton or Bobby Seale or anybody, or Huey Newton himself?
Bobby Seale,
yeah.
Huey Newton, Erica Huggins, and Eldridge Cleaver
are
the names that, and we met. I knew who they were. They knew who I was, not intimately, but we did have a relationship.
Okay. Wow. Okay. And so from the way you describe the group, did you have ties to either, you know, the Communist Party of the USA or the Soviet Union, or I don't know if the PRC had any groups in the US at the time, although the Panthers were very, you know, very much Maoist. Did you pick up your Maoism from the Panthers, or I mean, you seem to be very you know, ideologically almost Leninist in that sense. So did you have these sort of international links?
No, I don't think so. Our main links were to China. The CP, Russia, were considered revisionists, meaning so we pretty much disdained Russia's version of communism.
Imperialist, kind of the way, like the Maoist line.
I wouldn't say imperialist, just the wrong, they were just on the wrong path.
Right.
And they didn't really follow a true Leninist ideology. Mm-hmm. And So I wouldn't say, I mean, we weren't literally enemies, but we certainly didn't respect them. And I'm pretty sure they didn't respect us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, there are, in some of the stories you have in your book, for instance, you talk about some of the weapons that that your group had, like M1 carbines, 30-06s, shotguns, Colt 45s and whatnot. Now, I was really wondering, you know, like, where did you guys get money to buy these guns? How did it happen? Because, I mean, in Trinidad, now, the groups I was talking about before is when I grew up in Toronto, so the anarchist groups and that type of stuff and the liberation theology. But when I came to live in Trinidad, I got to know a lot of the revolutionary movements and groups down here as well. And there was something, a group here called the National Union of Freedom Fighters, that, you know, was an armed group here. And they would sometimes do, you know, bank robberies. It would hide out in the hills. And they were also, like, you know, the sons and daughters of young, privileged black people in the Trinidad and Tobago, you know, from the elite. But they, you know, had gone off there. And I know, you know, some college professors and stuff, some university professors who helped them get their supplies, get their probably weapons as well, money for weapons and stuff like that. So there was those kind of linkages. What was it like for you guys? Like, how did that, you know, how did that work? Was it your own money you guys bought this stuff with? How did that work?
I was, as I say in the book, there was a very stringent hierarchy, and I was pretty much on the lowly level being a college student. I don't really know how, well, yeah. I do know that they got their guns from gun shows, mm-hmm. and I do know they had fundraising, that we all were meant to contribute a certain amount of our income, which mine was pretty much zero, but to the organization. I couldn't say anything more than that. I was never privy to that information.
Okay. All right. Okay. So now, in terms of your time with the Revolutionary Union, do you have regrets? Do you have any regrets? And if so, what are they?
I don't have regrets. I was young and very idealistic. And here was an ideology that made sense to me. And that experience was, as all experiences are that one goes through, pretty key to the person that I've become. Regrets? No, I really don't. There's several things that I feel very alienated from. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it made sense to me. And my only question, which I believe I start in the prologue explaining, maybe not, but that how did I, out of the millions of people marching, out of the millions of activists for civil rights and anti-war and against Black oppression, how did I get so far out that I joined an organization as singular and violence-based as the RU? And that's the question, that's kind of the through line through my book, that's the question that I sought hard to answer. I go into my past to look at who I was before then. I look at where I went from there. So yeah, no regrets.
Right. But so what's the story of you leaving the group? Just how did you leave? Why, you know, if you can just explain that to the audience.
Should I tell the longer story or the shorter story?
We can start with the shorter one if you want. Okay. But we don't mind if you take a little excursion now and again.
Some things happened that made me feel very abandoned by my comrades, which is something that I would have never expected, because one thing about being in an organization like the RU is that these other people in your collective have your back. And an occasion happened that nobody had my back. And I was very hurt and very angry. And I had a meeting with Barry Greenberg, the regional collective head, as I had said. And he was chastising me for this role, for what had actually happened. And I that wasn't how I saw it. I was beat up by three Latino, young Latinos, teenagers who thought that I was gay. And his response was that how could I not be sympathetic to an oppressed community who, by their religion and by their experiences, were anti-gay. And I was just outraged because it wasn't as if I had initiated the violence. And I said, you know, I was abandoned. This happened. Nobody came to me. Nobody inquired how I was. And I went to see him the next day, and he was, like I said, chastising me. And I just blew up at him. I felt like, you know, as I said, so betrayed. And I just stood up and said, I quit, which shocked him and shocked me. But I felt so violated, and I walked out, and that was the end of my being a member of the Revolutionary Union.
Right, right. So now, I mean, it's interesting. Your commitment was to this wider social revolution, you know, a global revolution, really, probably, yes, the Maoism. When you left for, you know, those personal reasons, ideologically, did you also, you know, abandon the ideology, how did you reconcile that ideology?
I had already been on the fence about a couple of things that were critical to being a member of the Revolutionary Union. There were two things. One, the guns, because deep down in my heart, I was not a violent person or a proponent of violence. And the casualness or the seemingly casual attitude towards the guns was never something I was comfortable with. Then there was I was discouraged from maintaining friendships that went back to my early adolescence and even childhood, because those people were not revolutionaries. And I was pretty much like reading the novels, maintaining those friendships secretly. But I am by nature a pretty personal person. The way I communicate is very much on a personal level. And it was so hard for me to maintain the revolutionary line, to talk to people only in context of the intention to recruit them. So those things had been brewing for quite a while. And in my explosion, I think that those things were part of what precipitated it, my leaving. Right.
You know, a lot of these, you know, these groups, even, you know, from reading your book and from my own experiences with them, so, I mean, they share so much of the traits of a cult, you know, like a religious cult. And, you know, just like the thing, you're supposed to, you know, cut off your relationships with your family or friends or people who are, you know, all interaction has to be, you know, for recruitment and ideological reasons. Do you also agree that, you know, there's a sort of definitely this cultish aspect towards it? And what's your reflections and your experiences of that?
When I left the organization, I stumbled a lot because they had defined my relationship with people and the way I thought for so long. And it had gotten so deep in me that I had to, it's as if I had to relearn a new language to mm-hmm. be able to communicate with people who weren't in the group. And it took a long time. There were certain rites of passage that one goes through in their late adolescence and early 20s that I had not. So I had a lot of catching up to do. I still remember it was a year later, and I was with a close, close friend who had always had mixed feelings. Well, not mixed feelings. She'd always been very adamant against the Revolutionary Union and my involvement in it. And we were walking, and I just came out of nowhere. And can I swear on this show?
Guess, yeah, I don't know actually what the rules are of swearing, but I guess in context you can do it.
Well, what I said to her was fuck the RU, right. And that's when I began to see that it was a cult. There was, like I said, a very specific hierarchy. It was patriarchal. All men at the top, white men at the top. There were a couple of women, but in his, you know, they were wives of the elite in the organization. And, you know, by the definition of brainwashing, I do concur that that was happening. And even the way when I left, I kept my involvement with the organization a secret for many, many years, because what was truly driven into me is the importance of the security, and that we should not talk about the organization in terms of its internal workings, that it was only okay to talk about it in terms of the ideology. And I felt very guilty for leaving. I felt very embarrassed also for having gone so far out. So I didn't talk about it for many, many, many years. Nobody knew. In fact, people who've read the book who are old friends have been writing, I had no idea. I did not know that this is something you had done. I thought I knew everything about you. It's been very interesting to hear those responses.
Yeah, yeah. So so it's interesting, your friend that sort of sparked this epiphany and this sort of breaking through for you. Was she political in any way at all, or was she just apolitical?
She was apolitical in terms of not being an activist, but she was political minded, in terms of civil rights and fairness at large. But the thing that she said when I said that is, Jody, I've been waiting for a year to hear you say that. She was so happy. Right. She was just so happy by that revelation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I find a lot, you know, from these groups and involvement that a lot of the times, like when you see some of these violent explosions and whatnot, they say it's for, you know, the overthrow of capitalism or whatnot. But it, you know, you look in their eyes and you see they're angry with their father, or there's some sort of family drama there, It's something very personal psychologically that they're trying to work out, and the ideology becomes a sort of this way for them to vent a lot of these problems. And I know in your book you do look at a lot of the personal psychology, you know, a bit of the family drama, your father, and you talk about self-hate. Could you expand on that a little bit more for us, please?
First, let me respond to what you said initially. I don't know that people were, essentially protesting their parents. Mm-hmm. I really can't speak to that. I know that we were a generation of people who really felt that the world was being cheated of the opportunity. Of many opportunities because of the elitism. I mean, it's the same as it is today, though it's even actually worse. There, in my own case, is as difficult as my family was, and the fact that I always felt outside of them, I don't know in the long run how much that influenced my organization. I mean, my joining the organization. I really don't. Right. I think that my personality and character were formed early on, and the type of character that was formed was very rebellious against the against conventional culture. And you know, you have to remember, I lived in Los Angeles, which was really a hotbed of uprising against the culture. I mean, there was our own cultural revolution going on, and I was drawn to that like a moth to flame. I always felt that was where I felt at home. In terms of the self-hatred, that was much more a function of my physical appearance, for which I never was comfortable in my skin and was picked on, maybe we would say bullied, when I was younger. And one of the attractions of the RU was that they really didn't care what I looked like. They didn't really care what size shoe I wore, or that, you know, my hair was frizzy or any of those things. I was accepted as a fellow comrade because of the way that, because I agreed with the principles. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think that is very interesting. And I think that, you know, that's very true, you know. So, you know, with a lot of those movements, you know, because they have a critique of what the, you know, of normal society, if you want to put it that way. So a lot of people who might feel awkward feel accepted inside there. And so that's part of the attraction. And there's certainly, you know, the ideology is part of that. So, yeah, that's interesting.
There were more than a few people who had been raised in that environment, whose parents were Marxists, who were influenced, who basically came forward to be in our generation of Marxist-Leninists.
Right. And your own family, as you mentioned in the book, were not from that tradition, but they were sort of more, liberal Democrats, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, we're Jewish and mm-hmm. Jews are, at least then, I don't think it's true now anymore, were always more liberal minded than Gentiles. That's just sort of, you know, that's our heritage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. And so their support of, did they know of your activity? Because I mean, it's interesting. You mentioned how, you know, one of the guys aiming the guns at the door, anticipating this pig from coming in, was living with his parents.
I don't know what his situation was, but he was, like I said, he was pretty young. And I don't know what his family thought. My parents eventually knew that I was involved in the anti-war movement, but they did not know that I was a communist. I just never would have shared that with them. They would not have felt good about it. They would not have been happy about it at all. And my father did express concern that I was on the streets marching. And I reassured him that, yes, I was, but I wasn't violent. I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't losing my head, is what he was concerned about.
Right.
They didn't know, and I'm skipping forward to what will happen later in the book, but they did not know until the FBI came to visit them and told them I was a communist. And this was, you know, pretty much almost before this was after the time that I quit. And, you know, they were pretty, if I was still in the organization, it would have been a different conversation. But as it were, it was just more that they worried about the situation that I might be potentially set up for.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, you mentioned your Jewish heritage and whatnot, and the head of the Revolutionary Union, I believe, also was Jewish, right? And in the whole communist movement, I mean, in New York City, in LA, there's a very, like, among the Trotskyists in particular, and there's a very strong Jewish element. And I know a lot of the, you know, Caribbean Marxists and a lot of the third world nationalists, sometimes who studied in New York or whatever, would find themselves, you know, in those organizations and the ethnic factors to the left wing movement, to the communist movement are very interesting, like the Garveyites and the communists and the third world nationalists and the Indian nationalists and among the Jewish people, you had this sort of the Zionists versus the communists for a long time when we were talking mid-century and from before. These things are actually quite interesting to me. But did your family have any sort of experience? I know I hear a lot of Jewish people saying, oh, you know, yeah, there's always some uncle somewhere who was involved in this communist movement somewhere in the back. Did your family have any sort of
I was the only one. Right. There were none of, I mean, my family were all basically in business. My father was an insurance broker. It was a mom pop office. My mom worked with him. My grandparents, my grandfather was a truck driver, and then he owned a couple of trucks for delivery services. Nobody in my family was wealthy. Well, there is a cousin who was, but certainly, no, I don't think they really gave any thought to civil rights or the Vietnam War. Eventually, you know, I mean, the Vietnam War was broadcast over and over every night in the news. And my father in particular did not support it, but they weren't by nature activists. As far as being Jewish, we were never an observant family. My mother for sure, though not, you know, not in a stand-up kind of way, was a Zionist, because they were from a generation where Jews needed a place to gather, and they didn't really think about the fact that the Palestinians were being displaced, which I did. And I, you know, to this day, I am embarrassed by Israel and feel like, you know, they've done so much wrong to the Palestinian people that there are a lot of Jews that feel that way, actually, but more don't.
You know, this is, let me talk about this issue a little bit more. This idea of intersectionality, you're aware of that issue, that notion?
Well, I do know what it means, but in what context are you talking about?
I just want to explore it a little more, because you talked about when you were beaten up by some Latino youths, right?
And, That's right.
So there was that conflict there. Between, you know, I guess you could say feminism, nonviolence, ethnic, I suppose class element was inside there as well. So intersectionality is made a big sort of deal today that, you know, okay, it's like you stack the oppressions, and whoever has the highest stack of oppression is supposed to be the most privileged in this sort of inverted way, has the privilege to speak about against oppression. But there are so many contradictions, for instance, like even in the Black Lives Matter movement, right? And let's say in Black nationalism as a whole, right? I mentioned some of the ethnic contradictions between certain ethnic groups, but then also even things like, you know, attitudes toward homosexuality, right? Which you also mentioned in the Latino group, and then so you mentioned with the Zionists as well, the Palestinian issue. That's kind of an intersectionality there, because you know, as the Jews are trying to establish their own homeland because of the oppression they have, they have felt, but then the Palestinian issue comes in there as well. So it seems that a lot of times this way of kind of simply equating groups because they are oppressed, it doesn't work out in reality, because they're oppressed in different ways, and each group, you know, internally has its own sort of oppressions, and it sort of seems like a formula for a kind of civil war. And I mean, I can sort of even see it now in the Black Lives Matter movement, the contradictions between, you know, some of the LGBTQ groups and the Black nationalist groups, and then, you know, some of the other groups, and they may soon be warring sort of amongst themselves. And your personal story about how you left, I think, captures some of that. I don't know if you have any reflections you want to make on that from your own experience and sort of what you're observing now as what's happening around in America.
Well, there certainly is our contradictions within the group. There's even in Palestine, there's those that rule Golan Heights, and then I'm forgetting, oh gosh.
West Bank.
And the West Bank, they're rivals.
That's right.
So, and then in Israel, we have the pro-Zionists, and in the younger generation, a large number of anti-Zionists. Here, the same thing happens. And within, the Black nationalists, are there still Black nationalists in terms of an organization?
Actually, last month I saw this video that kind of went viral about this group. I believe it was in Atlanta, and asking for Texas, and they were marching all like armed, like a kind of a revival of the Black Panthers in a big way. It was really, really interesting. But the Panthers never wanted a state. That was more like the Nation of Islam.
Exactly.
But these guys were like, the tactics and look of the Panthers, but with the demands of the Nation of Islam. So that was very interesting.
Yeah, I do remember that. That was a bit confusing to see. But, you know, I think ultimately there are those that the more charismatic leaders who have risen because of their offering. Well, as the RU did for me, because if they're offering a vision of a possibility of a world that raises people above what their day-to-day life is. And those, you know, whether be they Black nationalists, be they Black Panthers. I mean, the Black Panthers, you have to remember, were much more about bringing lunches to the school kids and educate in education and, you know, bringing programs to the community than they were ever about their guns. There are contradictions within each group ideology, and you know, because ultimately it comes down to the leaders who are essentially ego driven and not necessarily sensitive to the needs of those whose needs are very strong.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you know, from my own sort of life journey and intellectual journey, you know, a lot of these ideologies, you know, they have these views of the world with angels and demons, but in the end, we are all, you know, flawed humans, and so even within the group you idealize as you know, the most angelic, you know, oppressed group, you know, you'll find ugly things inside us all, and we will all recognize it because we have it all in our own groups, and it's all part of the human experience.
I agree. That's been my experience as well, though when I was younger, I very much saw things in terms of black and white. There were good people, there were bad people. And the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, I do say something about this in my book, that I revered Ho Chi Minh, I thought definitely put on a pedestal. When the war ended and the North Vietnam were declared victors, he then led his army down the shores of the Mekong Delta and setting to fire villages that he believed housed individuals sympathetic to the South Vietnamese and American side. And that just so upset me. I felt like, how could he do that? Well, it's the same way that how could Jews be so insensitive to the Palestinians? You think that these are a people who have been themselves so marginalized that they ought to have empathy and sensitivity towards other populations with the same sort of experience. And when Ho Chi Minh did that, it threw me for several years.
Really?
Because I felt like I had so misjudged them, the North Vietnamese. I had so misjudged him that I just couldn't. I just lost confidence in my ability to discern and have any kind of confidence in my own political opinion.
Right. Yeah. I can understand that. I can definitely understand that. Now, when you left the group, what about your politics? How did your politics change?
My politics have actually never changed, but being no longer an activist, I didn't, act on them. I stayed in San Jose for another year just because that's where I lived but not being, not in any way being on the streets. And then I moved to Vancouver, British Columbia, kind of on a spur of the moment sort of thing. And the people who I became close with were not people who were political at all. Mm-hmm. And I just, sequestered that part of me and I never spoke of it to anybody. But internally, my feelings about what was right and what was wrong. I still did have a Marxist point of view, but it was not shared or acted on for many, many years.
Right, right. Did you find yourself embracing political personalities or causes later on that you wouldn't have anticipated before? You know, there's a lot of people that take a journey from, you know, that like the Crystals, for example, from being Trotskyists to being neocons and founding the neocon. Did you sort of ever embrace any sort of conservative groups or personalities because you saw some of the dangers that extremism on the left may have led to? Was that a part of your journey at all?
Never. I mean, I'm so not a conservative by nature. Mm. And what I also would never embrace was another kind of hierarchy, another kind of organization. I think it was more the closed-mindedness, the singular point of view of the movement that I rejected, but it was really not the I was always, you know, even though I was a quiet leftist, I've never not been. And now with everything that's happened, well, it was with Iraq when we invaded Iraq, and that woke me up again. And I was, and then with the women's movement, the Not Me movement, mm-hmm. I was back on the streets again for that. And now with Black Lives Matter, to tell you the truth, I'm not physically well enough to put myself on the street, but one of my daughters, actually both of my daughters, but one in particular has been very active. And honestly, I'm just couldn't be prouder of her.
Right, right, right. And so this is interesting in terms of the way you've kind of sequestered your life. And I always find this very interesting about, you know, you wonder where all these, you know, radicals from the 60s went to, and you know, and you find them in very surprising places afterward, you know, and they've kind of hidden that past away, which I always find strange. I don't know if strange is a word, but I wish it would be more openly integrated into their sort of personalities and life history. I want to, because it's surprising that sort of people either in business or in politics or in other establishment places that had these very, very radical pasts. You yourself became a chiropractor, correct?
And that's right.
And you didn't sort of continue along a political path. And at the beginning of in the preface for your book, when you talk about, I suppose, what motivated you, it's when you found this box of stuff and memorabilia from these years. So is it that your family was totally unaware, or, you know, they had just some vague idea? Yeah, what was was it a moment of a personal revelation you have to make to your family as well? What was that like?
My husband knew, because, you know, as in any close relationship, talking mm-hmm. about where we've come from was important.
Yeah.
I had two-pronged, and I think I mentioned earlier, responses to that time in my mind. One is that, well, most of all, it was, how do you tell people that you were once involved in a violent, so far left organization, because the people that I met were not political. And as a chiropractor, I certainly didn't want my patients and my friends at the time. The only friends who knew were the people who I had been friends with for many years and were witness to that time. My daughters didn't know. Nobody in my family, well, my family is, you know, like a handful of people, but none of them knew. And I was embarrassed. Mm-hmm. I was embarrassed because I, you know, was aware that path was so rarely taken by others that I would meet. And I was embarrassed that I felt guilty, because at the very end of the conversation that I had with Barry, where I was leaving, after I said I'm quitting, he said, "I always knew you didn't have it in you. You're just too petty bourgeois. You never made a good communist." And that was like, a knife to my stomach. I felt so guilty because I really wanted to be a good communist, yeah. and I did work hard at it. But he was right. I have to say he was right. But at the time, I was just so that the both the embarrassment and the guilt were the main reasons that I didn't say anything. It wasn't until I was writing the book that I would tell one person and then another person. And then as their responses were not what I expected, like, wow, I don't even want to know you. Instead, like, that's amazing you did that. That I began to realize that I had marginalized myself, that nobody else was going to do that. I told my daughters, who by then were, I believe, college age, or at least maybe a little younger, and they were proud of me. So it slowly became, what are you working on? What are you writing? And I tell people, and I was always like, oh, I don't know if I want to say anything. But their responses again were, you know, that was the zeitgeist of the time. We were all so angry. We didn't do what you did, but we applaud where you went. So that was when I began to be open about my involvement.
Right. And there's something I just want to jump back to that you mentioned, which was the FBI story with your parents. Could you just share a bit of that with the with our listeners here?
There was when was this? In the early 70s, but again, it was after I left the organization, that a report came out from a congressional subcommittee on radicals and revolutionaries in the Bay Area. And what they concentrated on in this book was the Revolutionary Union. Mm-hmm. And their information came by moles that the FBI had planted in the RU, who gave all of our names up, and little descriptions were put in the book that were, in my case, it said that I was an efficient crowd agitator and an active member of women's liberation. There was, so what they did is they went to my parents who lived in Los Angeles. I was at that point still in San Jose, and the FBI came to them and they knocked at the door, and my parents didn't let them. Well, my father was, you know, outraged and didn't let them in, but they told him that I was a communist, that I was a member of this organization, and that I needed to go to Washington to testify for the committee. And they made it sound like I didn't have any choice. Mm-hmm. And my parents called me that night really, really upset. And the first thing my father said was, "Are you a communist?" And I said, "Well, no, but I was." And they were like, "Is all this true about you?" And I said, "Yes." And then they just were, you know, and then the FBI came back to them again. At that point, my father basically just told them, you know, he was a man who had a tremendous, boundaries about people in power trying to disempower people like myself. And he just said, "No, she's not going to be going to Washington. No, you need to leave." But they did give him a copy of the book. And then within days, I was working as a factory on an electronic fabrication line. Okay. And at that point, I was working there not to recruit people. I wasn't part of a working organization, but I did have to make a living. And my skills were, I was a typist, bookkeeper, and I just didn't want to go back to that. So I got a job there, and a year into it, they went to my boss, my supervisor, I should say, and gave him a copy of the book. And then he called me in the next day, and I saw the book. And you know, you can just tell a government printed book, they always have sort of a pale gray, very poor presentation. And I saw it, and I just sort of sank into my chair. And he turned to the page which had my picture on it and said, "Is that you?" And I was like, "Duh, yeah, it is me." And he asked the same question as my parents: "Are you still part of this organization? I don't see any sign of organizing in your day-to-day work." And I said, you know, "No, I'm not part of it. And no, I was not there to organize." But the company was going towards high security, because what they were manufacturing were electronic components that were about to be in everything that we use, from radios to radars.
That was in California.
In the center of the what would become the tech movement, but in the center of the what became Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And he said, you know, I can't keep you here. You would never pass security. So I left and I applied for several jobs at other fabrication organizations, and I didn't get them. And
can I just ask you a quick question here? So you were a factory worker on the assembly line there?
Yes.
Okay. So would your sort of Marxist past have sort of made that a much more romantic job than other people might have thought of it?
No, there was no romance about it. They had a newspaper article, you know, a newspaper, the work available in the newspaper. And like I said, I wasn't really qualified for anything else. Mm-hmm. So I just applied and I got it. And, you know, it was weird because I was not working class and the people I was working with were.
Yeah.
But my family,
the proletariat. You were a better communist than Greenberg.
Yeah. He never worked in a factory. But my family, you know, two generations ago, my grandparents had immigrated secretively. They came over to the United States in steerage, and they were all working class themselves. So I wasn't really so far away. My father was an insurance broker, but even then he didn't really start to make money until I had left the house, you know? So I wasn't raised in any kind of a luxurious environment at all. So, you know, working in a factory, it wasn't really a political choice at all. It was just, I need a job. They were hiring and I got there.
Good, good. Right. Well, you know, we're I've kept you here for an hour, so we should probably wrap up. I've kept you long enough. But what sort of message would you like to leave your readers? Because I guess I'll step back a little. You started writing this in what, around 2012?
Yes.
Right. So at that time, very different from today. Now it's published in the middle of this. It's a kind of revolutionary moment, right? In a way it wasn't there. So there's got to be a lot of resonance that you perhaps didn't anticipate in 2012. So what messages do you think your work has for today? And what message would you like your readers to take away from your book, reading it today in this moment?
The message, I would want people to stand up for what they believe in, to not be passive observers, to join in any way they can, if it's donating, if it's on the streets with Black Lives Matter. I see the millennial generation as being, I'm very hopeful about this generation. You know, they've been protesting since the Iraq War. They've been protesting, our invasions into Afghanistan. They've been out there overtly in protest in ways that that give me, like you said, a lot of hope and a lot of promise. And I hope that this is there's this very big consciousness now about white privilege, which we certainly didn't have. I never really thought of, which is, I think, a huge, huge revelation, you know, for people to become educated about that, to really know that our experience as white people is very different from those of even maybe our next door neighbors or our friends as Black people or people of color, I should say, because it's also true for the Latino people, that I'm hoping that education and consciousness will lead us to a place that is very, very different from what we've had. I mean, the police brutality that we've been witnessing is so horrific, and that's radicalizing people. So, as far as what they got out of my book, I think that it's really important to have context, to have history of the movement against the ruling class. And there are a lot of people who really weren't aware of feminism. I was, right at the second wave of feminism. Mm-hmm. And now this is the third wave of feminism. And I think that history is really critical to a depth of understanding what has occurred and still what needs to occur.
All right. Are you going on a book tour at all? Or, I know it's not possible physically, really.
That was so hard for me because I did have, I'm doing my own marketing. My publisher is very small. There's no publicist. I made, you know, it was very alien to me, but I did make a huge effort and was successful ultimately in lining up bookstores. But of course, that's that. So what I've been doing is soliciting virtual bookstores that are having virtual events. Many of them are already booked. Many of them have backed away because they didn't realize, you know, they don't have the bandwidth for it.
Right.
But I have booked several, and I've booked podcasts like yours. I've been on blogs. I've been have had interviews both on social media, and I've been on two radio shows. There's a third one coming up. This is all small time, but I really want to get the word out there. I didn't write the book for financial benefit. I don't expect it. It's you know, it's a very what's the word? It's definitely
niche.
Yes, exactly that. I think it's an important book in this day and time, and I really hope that gets widespread coverage in widespread readership.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll help you out here. We get 1.5 million downloads per month, so that's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this. I am grateful both for the conversation because you ask very good questions and for the opportunity to be featured on your show.
Great. Are there any other projects you're working on right now, or this is basically what you're concentrating on?
Well, as the time is going, I mean, I do have other events coming up towards the end of September and even in October, but there's not really much concentration to be done. Before I wrote this, I'm a short story writer, primarily short fiction.
Okay.
And I don't really think I've got there's a need for another memoir. I do write essays that I have. Some have been published, some have not. And I think I'm really returning just to short fiction and to essay writing.
Excellent, excellent. So where can readers find your work and maybe your, you know, your appearance dates and stuff like that? You have a website, right?
I have a website. I have yet to put my appearances on it, which is only because I need my daughter, my millennial daughter, to post those. And I will make sure of that. And there will be links. And is this recorded? Will there be a link to it?
Yeah. We can put it on the page, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, but here, my website is https colon, or am I right about colon?
Yeah.
/ www.jodyaforester.com.
Okay, great.
And that tells a lot about the books. That has links for purchasing it. Please purchase.
Well, excellent, excellent. Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been very enlightening and enjoyable. Once again, the book is Guns Under the Bed, Memories of a Young Revolutionary. And we've been speaking to the author, Jodie Forester. It's been a pleasure.
Mine too. Thanks so much.
Thank you also to you, our listeners. I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of New Books in Politics and Polemics on the New Books Network.